Welcome to the Nurture Hub Pregnancy and Birth Podcast with your hosts, Shari Lyon and Nicola Lay.
Together, we bring over 30 years of experience in working with women and partners through education, breathing, mindfulness, and evidence-based information, and nurturing you through this transformation into motherhood.
Join us on this journey as we connect with women and partners, mentoring, supporting, and navigating the ups and downs of becoming parents. Welcome to episode 13 of the Nurture Hub Pregnancy and Birth Podcast with your host, myself, Shari Lyon, and the beautiful Nicola Lay.
And today we have the privilege to interview Dr. Rachel Reed. Now, Rachel is a senior lecturer and a discipline leader in midwifery at the University of Sunshine Coast in Australia. She has provided midwifery care for hundreds of women in a range of settings in the UK and Australia. Now, Rachel's PhD explored women's experience of birth and midwifery practice during birth. She is a writer and a presenter and the author of Midwife Thinking blog site. Rachel is originally from north of England, but now lives in Queensland, Australia.
This episode is a juicy one, and I recommend you flag this episode as you may need to come back and listen to this a few times to really absorb all of the information that Rachel is sharing with us today about induction and the different types of induction. And it's just so juicy. We were so, Nicola and I were sitting here going, mind blown, having mind blown moments. So
grab a cup of tea, pen and paper, and just really absorb all. Good morning, Rachel. Very, very pleased to have you on here today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. Nicola and I actually saw you live at one of your talks at the Gold Coast University Hospital last year. And can I just say, you really, for us as childbirth educators and when we, supporting women, you really did open our eyes up a lot more about induction and I guess when it is necessary compared to maybe when it's maybe an in case of model of care. So thank you for one, your book. For those of you who are listening, Rachel has written a book called Why Induction Matters. And actually when I first say that title, a lot of people are like, oh, yes. What do you mean? And I'm like, no, don't be fooled by the name. Okay. It's actually probably one of the best, easy to read books that I have read, like as a childbirth
Absolutely.
Educator, and it just gets kind of straight to the point, but it's very much evidence-based. So would you like to just give us a little bit of your background as a midwife and how you came into, you've got your PhD, is that right? And then writing the book.
Yeah. Okay. So I started in England, as you can probably hear from my accent, mm-hmm. and from the north of England. So I did a Bachelor of Midwifery, not nursing, so I'm not a nurse, and worked in England in a big regional referral unit and then out in the community. And I absolutely loved being a community midwife. And we cared for women wherever they were birthing. And then moved to Australia and struggled to kind of fit into what was happening here. It was much more like the American system where midwives were nurses and much more medical control. So tried various different settings, private hospital, public hospital, and ended up in private practice because I felt that was the only way I could carry on providing full care to women and not be kind of losing my scope of practice. And at the same time, I did a PhD, really because I kind of, when I finished my degree in England, which was a Bachelor of Honours, I said I would never study again. And, really resented having to do an honours, which is a bit of research as part of my degree, because I just wanted to be a midwife. But seeing what was happening in the maternity system and just not understanding why, how come we're doing this when the research says that, kind of headed me back into study and back into research. And kind of that's why I did my PhD, really, was looking at what midwives do and why they do it and how women experience that during birth. And then ended up in teaching, and none of this was planned, and now I'm, a senior lecturer in midwifery, and really kind of focus my energies on research and writing. but trying to bring into that the woman back into it, you know, so trying to do research around women's experience of birth and focusing on physiology and reclaiming all of that knowledge that we had until medicalization came along. So that's really my focus, I guess. And the induction book, I was asked to write that. It's part of a series called Why X Matters. So that's why the title's Why Induction Matters. And it was a UK publisher and they asked me to write it. And I thought, I'd always said I'd never ever write a book after finishing my thesis because it was just torturous. And I thought, no, that's actually, I'll have a go at this. And it was a really good exercise in consolidating huge amounts of research into just kind of language that is understandable and real kind of summarizing it. So I actually won't say enjoyed, I don't enjoy writing, but I enjoyed the putting together of that book and the finishing of it. And it's been quite handy because I don't keep things in my head. So I use to dip into to kind of check up on things. So that's why I wrote that book. And at the moment I'm busy writing my next book, which is kind of my PhD, really exploring physiology and intervention, but in the, so looking at that, but also looking at women's experiences and history and how that's influenced our perceptions of birth and our practices in birth. And so that's where my head is at the moment. So I'll see if I can pull it back into induction.
Yeah, beautiful. And I think that's where, why we actually love your book, because we are not medically trained. You know, we are both mums who have gone through, the two of us, and we were speaking about this before actually, very different births, very different experiences. But for us, and for a lot of women who aren't medically trained, reading some of those research papers and the evidence-based research, it can just be so overwhelming. So that's why I love your book, because it brings the research together in a way that those of us who don't understand medical terminology or those big words, and to be able to understand, okay, well, these are actually the risks, the benefits, but also the alternatives. So that's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. One of the things I really kind of drew from your book, or we both did, was how you explain what the difference is between a variation in labor compared to a complication. Can you just please just explain to our listeners, you know, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, and this is a really difficult concept in the current maternity system that kind of sees everything as an emergency or a complication. And I know student midwives really struggle with this, so it's not easy. But essentially you have, so physiology is the body functioning healthy in a healthy way. So that's why I talk about physiological birth rather than natural birth, because nature includes, you know, pathology and complications. You know, look at the coronavirus, that's a naturally occurring virus. So I avoid nature. So physiological is a term that's used for the body working in a healthy way with a healthy outcome. And there's lots of variations within that. So women's bodies are unique. They all work differently. So some women's pelvises will mean that their babies face outwards rather than face their back. That's a variation. It's not a complication. There's nothing wrong happening there. It's just a variation to the standard kind of blueprint. So most women will have a variation of their pregnancy or their birth, because they're not going to be, nobody's normal. So it's basically a slight variation, but there's nothing wrong happening right now. Nothing's going wrong. But some variations can increase the chance of certain complications happening. So for example, breech is a variation, but there are certain complications that are associated with breech, not necessarily going to happen, but are more likely to happen with a breech baby than a head down baby. So that's where this kind of system gets very excited about variations, because they get really focused on the potential complications. So complication is when something is actually going wrong. So this is a pathology. You know, preeclampsia is a complication where the woman's body is actually in a pathological process, or an obstetric emergency, like, you know, shoulder dystocia or a massive hemorrhage. That's also a complication. So, and there's a real difference, but we often treat variations as if they're complications. before anything actually happens.
Okay. So you're kind of saying that there's always a time and place for medical intervention, isn't there? But is it becoming more common in this country, within Australia, that is, that we are having a lot, or women are having induced or having a lot of intervention based around an in case of model of care instead of a because of? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, most inductions. Yeah, and most inductions happen because of a variation. So they happen like just in case, rather than, you know, in response to a complication. So, for example, a woman who has preeclampsia, that's a pretty serious complication. And induction is done in that case because of a complication that is actually happening, versus offering an induction to a woman because she has a variation that increases her chance of something happening. It doesn't mean it's happening, but there's an increased chance. And what we've got now in Australia is a general induction rate of, well, these are figures from 2017, but they're the latest ones because there's a lag. 33% of women in general, but that if you look at so what the Australian government do is they look at a low risk group of women just to kind of look at what's happening to that group. And this is a group of women having their first babies who are having, you know, uncomplicated pregnancies. And in that group, the induction rate is 43%. So this is a group of women who do not have a complication, and that's their induction rate. So those inductions are being done for variations.
Wow, that's a lot higher than what...
Absolutely. So what is the difference between an induced labour compared to spontaneous labour?
Oh, it's a completely different kettle of fish, as they say. And I think this is not appreciated by women or midwives, because midwives are so used to looking after women who are being induced that they forget. So, you know, often I'll have students who are talking about labour and birth, and they'll be talking about a natural blah, blah, blah. And then when you go, hang on, but the woman was being induced, so this was not a natural labour. So it's very different from a physiological birth from the beginning all the way through to the end. So if we look at physiology at the beginning, labour is initiated by the baby. So once the baby's lungs have matured and its brain is ready, it sends a message to the mother's placenta. And the mother's placenta sends out a message to the woman's body, which creates all kinds of changes. You know, there's increased oxytocin receptors in her uterus. It just changes everything. It kind of prepares her body for the birth and for the baby. So that doesn't happen in induction. Another important thing that happens for the baby is in the hours leading up to birth, there's changes in the brain that protect the baby's brain from fetal distress. That doesn't happen. So you've got a mother and a baby who are about to go through labour not prepared. So the kind of protective mechanisms that would naturally occur don't occur. So that's at the beginning of labour. You also don't get kind of the early labour. So, you know, as you know, with physiological labour, early labour is quite a long part of that for most women. You know, they've got many hours where their hormones are kind of gearing up and their endorphins are starting to release. So once they get into that really established pattern, they've got good capacity for dealing with the pain because they've got high endorphin levels. So that doesn't happen in induction. We kind of go straight from let's get this thing going. And the contractions are very different. So I don't know if you've experienced, you know, if you talk to women who have experienced a physiological contraction pattern versus induction, you know, they'll tell you it was different. It's different. So when a contraction, so for a woman who's birthing physiologically, contractions are really kind of a dance between her and the baby and the physiology and what else is happening, and regulated by her brain. So you'll get different patterns for different women depending on the needs of their babies. So I learned this. The best lesson I got in this was looking after a woman who was having her first baby who only ever had contractions kind of 5 minutes apart with the closest they ever got. So she was never in established labour. And she had a long labour, of course, because the contractions were really spaced out. And then she pushed this baby out, again, very spaced out contractions. And the baby was in the amniotic sac, and out he came. And he was quite a scraggy little thing. You know, he wasn't he wasn't small, but he looked like he could have done with a bit more feeding. And his placenta wasn't fantastic. And that was the labor he needed. Because if she'd had more powerful contractions, he would have got distressed. You know, he couldn't have managed that. So there's this really important interplay between mother and baby that we can't see and we don't know. We don't know what the baby needs. So for physiological labor, that's going on. Induction, you follow the protocol. So you're putting synthetic oxytocin. So it is exactly the same molecule. So Syntocin or Pitocin in America is oxytocin. It looks the same if you kind of look at the molecule, but it's the behavior of it in the body and how it's released that is different. So it's not coming from the brain. So the woman's in physiological labor has got it released in the brain. It's interacting with the baby. It kind of can down regulate, up regulate, depending on what's happened. And you'll see in a physiological labor very different things happening. Like you'll have different patterns at different points in the labor. It'll all slow down once she's pushing the baby out to give the baby more space between contractions. So that's all going on. You've also got, because it's released in the brain, it's bathing the woman's brain. So she's getting prepared for bonding behaviors. It's going through the placenta into the baby's brain. If you're putting it directly into a woman's vein, which is what you do during a labor, it can't get into her brain because of the blood-brain barrier. So there is no kind of bathing of the brain in preparation for bonding behaviors. It can get through to the baby through the placenta, but at much higher doses than it would from the mother. And we're not sure about the long-term impacts of that. And what it does is we turn it up so that the woman's having contractions three to four in 10 minutes is how we count it. And that's considered an effective contraction pattern. So you're regulating this contraction pattern according to a protocol, because you don't know what the baby and mother actually need. So you're just kind of having to go in at the 3 to 4 in 10. The woman hasn't had a build-up, and you get it so they're really strong contractions, 4 in 10, and you keep it at that. So women will often kind of describe, it actually feels different in the way that the uterus contracts, and it can not relax as well in between contractions as well. So basically, it's a pretty dangerous. Syntocin is the biggest cause of fetal distress, full stop, in labor. That's why, you know, it's really important to monitor the baby's heart rate, because it's very likely that at some point the baby will get distressed, because you're trying to titrate the contraction pattern with the need for the cervix to open at the same time, not stressing the baby out. And it's actually quite difficult. This is why there's a lot of surveillance and a lot of interventions around making sure that we monitor that the baby's okay. And for a lot of babies, especially with first labors, you're not going to get a good strong contraction pattern with Syntocin on that opens the cervix that doesn't stress the baby out. Which is, so most women end up having a cesarean for induction of labor, not because, you know, there's dramatic fetal distress, because if you see distress, you can turn the Syntocin on down. So, you know, it's not, you can stop that from happening. But what you end up with a situation where you can't turn the Syntocin on and up enough to make the woman's labor effective without stressing the baby out. So you keep turning it back down again. And then you turn it up, the baby gets stressed, and then you turn it down and it doesn't get contraction. So in the end, they just go, do you know what? Let's just do a cesarean, because this is going nowhere. So that's the usual reason for having a cesarean induction. It's not like a big dramatic, oh, the baby's stressed, let's do a cesarean, because you can turn the Syntocin off. So it's very different. And then the pushing phase. So if the woman gets to pushing her baby out, so in a physiological birth, that everything slows down at that point, because you've got these really strong, powerful contractions that are squashing the placenta, they're squashing the baby. The baby's head gets compressed in the vagina, so the baby's heart rate dips down because the vagal nerve is getting compressed. Perfectly normal. You would expect a baby's heart rate to dip down as its head's coming through the vagina. That's a normal, you know, it's not a problem, because babies can compensate for that. But because they're getting that compression, contractions tend to space out so that they get a really good perfusion of blood in between contractions. Again, with induction, that doesn't happen. We just keep on with the 3 to 4 in 10 contractions. And you're pushing the baby down, down, down without it having that resting space, not only for it to get oxygenated, but babies do a lot of wriggling and repositioning themselves in between contractions as they come through the pelvis, because they've got to do this you know, unlike other animals, our human babies have got to do quite a lot of rotation and wriggling to come through. And when the uterus is relaxed, they can use that space to wriggle and change position. When the uterus is tight in a contraction, they can't. They just get hammered down. So in a physiological labor, there's a lot of space where the baby, and women will say that, oh, they're wriggling around, that, oh, what's he doing? Because their baby's using that space to move. And in induction, they don't necessarily get that opportunity in the same way. So they're more likely to come through in a position that's not very helpful. They're also more likely to tear the perineum because they're coming through at a faster rate than the woman's body would have allowed the baby to come through. There would have been some, like, there would have been slower and there would have been more stretching. So the pushing phase is different. So the whole lay, and then afterwards, the placenta is different because we kind of have to carry on with the artificial oxytocin in induction. You can't just stop and then, you know, expect the placenta to come out because we've removed that kind of the natural oxytocin system. So the birth of the placenta is also impacted. So it's kind of all the way through. The labor is completely different and needs to be managed as a fairly dangerous. I can remember working with an obstetrician in the UK, and when you went to him and said, oh, could you prescribe some Syntocin on for whatever woman, because it had to be prescribed by a doctor for induction or augmentation, he would say, you say, okay, could you give me the rationale for prescribing this deadly medication?
Wow. Okay.
Just to make the point that as a midwife, you now had to rationalize to this obstetrician why you were planning on putting, and it was really good because it really made you go, oh yeah, and reminded you that this isn't just you get so used to it as a midwife. You just rock it up, you monitor it, you check the contractions. It becomes day-to-day work, and we forget how it's actually pretty dangerous medication for a baby.
And it's so interesting listening to you hear that again, as when I saw you live last year, is that's exactly how it felt. I went from being just normal like I am now to going straight into really intense contractions and out of control, and really just looking at and watching so many flurries of midwives coming in and out, trying to turn it down, baby in full distress. Even turning it down didn't stop my baby being distressed. So yeah, we ended up in a very long, laborious, you know, tick box procedure, really. No cervix dilating, lots of horrible internals, and then ended up in, you know, the emergency C-section. And yeah, when you say that, just really kind of, you know, it's a healing feeling because I was really out of control. So I hope that helps some of the listeners out there that have had that same experience. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think with pain, you know, when you're having a non-physiological birth, it's a completely different experience. And things like epidurals, like, it's different. You know, you're not having a physiological birth. Maybe an epidural is a good idea if you're going to go in.
It
with
was.
Kind of, exactly. So it's kind of, it makes me really upset when I kind of hear, you know, students or midwives saying, oh yeah, and like talking about an induction, and she did it with no pain relief. And I just think, did she want to do it with no pain relief?
I know. I got to 18 inductions. Hours. Yeah, 18 hours. And then I went, can I have some pain relief? And they were saying, well, what would you like? And I said, I don't know. So yeah, when I had the epidural, I went, why did no one tell me it was going to be this good? So yeah, feel
yeah. And I've worked with women who have actually wanted an epidural before the Syntocin goes up, you know, and that's a perfectly valid thing to do. If you're being induced, then it's not like an epidural is going to slow down the birth, you know, it's because they're reducing you. So it's, you know, you're not having that biofeedback. You know, it might increase the chance of some things happening, but you know, you're already having a very medically managed birth, and it might be a bit kinder to just go in for the epidural. It's like, you know, yeah, there's no bravery rewards for going through an induction. It's not a physiological birth. We need to remember that.
Thank you.
Wow, that's just such, so much information in what you've just spoken about, because you know what we see as educators and practitioners who support women is a lot of our women are, we find that we just talked about kind of maybe these, what we're finding is most common reason for labor induction. And we find, well, post dates. So women going over their estimated due date, I think is what we find many of our mums are coming to head with caregivers, and they're having that pressure put on them. If you haven't had your baby by this date, you know, and I always talk about, basically, like, I always bring it back to sex when I talk about my, not always, but when I talked about my couples, and I'm like, it's like, you know, saying to you going, well, if you don't orgasm by this particular time, then we're going to make your orgasm, like, we're going to do it for you, because the hormones that are at play, and we've talked about this many times in previous episodes, but I think it's just really important of realizing that stress is not going to then help with physiological spontaneous labor. And that is what we're finding. So many women are either being put under pressure, which is causing them stress by their medical caregivers, or they're putting the pressure on themselves to go into labor and trying all of these natural ways to induce labor. But what would you say, I guess, as a midwife, are you finding it are the most common reasons for induction?
Oh, being pregnant at the moment seems to be. It just seems to be every woman is gets into that. You need to have an induction point for whatever reason. You know, it just seems to be, you know, I guess you could take bets on what the reasons will be. But I think post dates is still a big one. But often women don't even get to the post dates because, you know, they're considered old or fat, or, you know, there's something wrong with you that means that you need to be induced. But I think, yeah, like, I guess the reasons I'm hearing the most are big babies and maternal age seem to be, alongside post dates, the biggies.
So what evidence on inducing women who are being told they have a big baby? Like, what is the evidence to that?
Well, firstly, you know if a woman's got a big baby. You know, that's one of the main issues, is gap can't be big or not. They're very in, so they get it wrong either 15% either way. So a scan's not a good way to know that you've got a big baby, for a start. So they're using that as the rationale. You know, the only way you can really tell the weight of a baby is to weigh the baby after it's born, and you know, that's, and then it's too late to make decisions. So if we look at guidelines, so what I tend to do when I kind of look at what's happening around a topic is I look at what guidelines say, and then I look at what the research says, because they're not necessarily the same thing, because clinical guidelines are often kind of, they're created by a group of people, and you know, you can imagine who has the most influence in that group around what guidelines end up. So if we look at NICE guidelines and World Health Organization guidelines, they say induction is not recommended for a suspected big baby. So you should not be offering induction based on your assumption that the baby is going to be big. So Queensland Health Guidelines, I don't know what the guidelines are in the other states, recommends that at 38 weeks, if the baby's estimated to be 3.9 kilos, which again, you can't estimate, that you would recommend an induction. However, another Queensland Health guideline that talks about gestational diabetes points out that estimation of fetal weight by clinical assessment or ultrasound can have significant margins of error. So they've contradicted themselves. So that's what the guidelines say. The research tells us that if you do actually have a big baby, which you don't know by a scan, then you do have an increased chance of shoulder dystocia. That's the shoulders getting stuck. And you know, that's between 1% and 9%, depending on how big the baby is. But that kind of mixes in gestational diabetic babies, which are, you know, a whole different story. They've got, you know, bigger shoulders. And it also increases your chance of severe perineal tearing. So if you've got a big baby, you've got an increased chance of tearing, but that's still 0.6%. It's not huge. And you've got an increased chance of hemorrhage, 1.7%, which is still not huge. So that's what we know. If you've got a big baby, those are the kind of risks associated with having a big baby. And we know that big babies are more likely to have issues with their blood glucose levels. Well, that's again, because this is the problem with research, it just lumps everything in. So this research is on big babies, but that includes babies who've got gestational diabetes. So you would expect that babies who have gestational diabetes will have blood sugar issues at birth. So a Cochrane review kind of, and that's, if you're looking at, research is biased. I know, you know, researchers think it's not, but I'm a researcher and it is biased. Because what the questions you ask and how you investigate, and the way that you interpret your findings is all kind of, you can find a study to tell you anything. So what I tend to do is go to Cochrane reviews, and that's a good idea for parents as well, because they've got, you know, if you do the search, the Cochrane database, they've got plain text summaries that explain the research in, you know, kind of non-researchy ways. So they're really good. So what the Cochrane reviews do is pull all the research that's been done on a topic, and they assess it, and they chuck out the crap bits, and they keep all the good research, and then they kind of combine all the results. So what the Cochrane reviews says for induction for a suspected big baby is it can reduce the shoulder dystocia rate from 3.8% to 4.1%. It can, but it increases the perineal tearing rate from 0.7% to 2.6%, and it increases the treatment for jaundice from 7% to 11%. So if you induce for a suspected big baby, you might reduce your chance that the baby's shoulders will get stuck, but, you know, baby's shoulders get stuck largely due to what care providers do, but you will increase your chance of tearing. And what's really interesting about the research is that it's not the size of the baby that causes problems. For a group of women, so they looked at groups of women who had suspected big babies, not necessarily big babies, but babies who had been labeled as big in pregnancy, and a group of women who didn't, but oops, a big baby came out unexpectedly. And it was the women who had been labeled as having a big baby that had all of the increased complications, not the women who actually did have a big baby who didn't know, which makes sense. So it's about how we perceive women who are carrying big babies, what we do to them, for example, inducing them, how we then panic around the birth and, you know, expect the baby's going to get stuck. So we do things and intervene that then create the problem that we then fix. That's probably the biggest thing, which makes sense because, you know, doing home births, I don't know why, but all women have huge babies at home births. It just seems to be generally what happens. Most babies are 4 kilos or over, and you don't know that until they come out, and it's like, oh, that's a big baby, and it doesn't tend to cause a problem because we don't know about it.
I just had a mum who I supported who ended up deciding to have a home birth due to COVID, and her baby was 10 pound 11, born in water, didn't tear. Yeah, and she's not a big girl either. I think it shocked everyone there, but she said it was the easiest birth because her first three were all induced. And I think too, it is so important for women to educate themselves on how they can work with their body, create pelvic mobility, create space for their babies, and not be on their backs on a bed. That is what's also going to help, even if baby is on the bit of a bigger side. It is working with your body and trusting that. And I think that's where with induction, because you're then hooked up to lines and you're on fetal monitors and things like that, it reduces mobility as well. Which, would you agree that can also
cause these problems? So what you do is you go, this woman's got with a big baby, we're all scared this baby's going to get stuck. So what we'll do is we'll do all these things that increase the chance of the baby getting stuck. And then the baby gets stuck, and then we reinforce that idea that the babies get stuck because they're big, not, well, the baby got stuck because the woman was coerced into having an epidural, was induced, was put on her back, so their pelvis was smaller and couldn't work with her baby to, you know, that part of the pushing phase is very much as, you know, women have kind of activated a little bit their cortex at that point. So they've gone through that kind of really liminal phase of labor where they're in that altered state, and then they get a boost of adrenaline that clears out their neocortex a bit. It's because that part of labor, that kind of pushing the baby out bit, requires a little bit of your brain working, because you actually need to be like connected to your baby, changing position in response to what's happening in your body and with your baby. And really then the care provider's role is about physically supporting the woman to get into positions that she is instinctively wanting to take, whether that's standing, squatting, kneeling, moving about. And it's actually I was just looking at this research for my new book that I'm writing, looking at what the research is around pelvises at that point in the labor when the woman's pushing. And what's interesting is, you know, a lot of the research focuses on positions and comparing different positions with positions, but it's actually the movement that increases the size mm-hmm. of the pelvis, not the static position. So when a woman's moving from one position to another, that's when her pelvis is the biggest, which makes sense because women do tend to move in that. If they're instinctively birthing, they kind of keep moving position, and then, like, you know, the baby will move in there and they'll go, oh, I need to be in this position now. That you take that away if you've got, you know, if you're got a woman strapped to a monitor on a bed with an epidural on her back, she can't move with her baby. And, you know, a big baby being induced, it hasn't got the space to shift and move in between contractions. If she's got an epidural, that's even worse because we've got now a relaxed pelvic floor, so the baby can't pivot against the pelvic floor, so it's more likely to come through the pelvis, you know, not nicely tucked in. So you're actually creating this kind of set of circumstances that's going to increase the chance that this baby gets stuck. And then we then use that as a rationale to say big babies get stuck, so we need to intervene. It just blows my mind.
Wow. Yes. That's so
definitely mind-blowing.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah,
but it's so right, like when we hear it, it's like it all makes sense though.
Well, totally
to us it does, but wow.
So we've seen a rise in induction for gestational diabetes. So what's your thoughts on this? We've had a lot of women asking about the induction with gestational diabetes.
Oh, I hate gestational diabetes. I wrote the blog post about it because I hate it. And I felt like, and I actually always write about things when I don't like them and I need to get my head around them because I feel like I don't understand it. So it's pretty complicated, but in short, the thresholds for what we're calling gestational diabetes, you know, where we're sticking the label has changed, which means that, you know, around about 17% of women in some settings have got gestational diabetes. So we're having increased numbers of women getting the label. And then with the label comes all of that kind of monitoring and recommendations for inductions, etc. However, if we look again at guidelines, so generally guidelines can't decide. So some guidelines will say you just induce for gestational diabetes, but actually most guidelines say if the blood sugars are normal, then you don't induce. So, you know, even Queensland Health, you know, the Queensland Health who want to be inducing babies that are big, actually says the induction of labour is not recommended if there's normal blood glucose levels. And that makes sense because what we know is it's not the label. The changes to the baby happen with high blood glucose levels. So it's the high blood glucose levels that alter the physiology of the baby that, you know, make a baby with big shoulders. That's the risk, you know. So if the blood sugar levels are normal, then that isn't a risk. So it doesn't make any sense to then say you've had this label, so we're now going to induce you. It makes more sense to go, well, let's have a look at what your blood sugars are doing. And if they're normal, your risk for that baby is no greater than a woman who hasn't got the label, because it's the blood sugars, not the label. So I'd quite like to get rid of the label of gestational diabetes. And then, you know, if people have to go ahead and test blood glucose levels in pregnancy, then maybe, okay, do that if women want that done. But then don't give labels, just look at the blood glucose levels during the pregnancy.
Yes, because it's kind of like they just, once you've been given that label, you're put in this box.
That's
and
right.
This box is a one size fits all. And it's like with many things, gestational diabetes, advanced maternal age, big baby, VBAC, you know, they just want to put you in this box, and the hospital policies, and it's all about control though, isn't it?
I think that's part of it, is understanding where our maternity system comes from. And the first chapter in my book is exploring that, because if you don't understand where it's come from and how it functions, then you can't really navigate through it. And, you know, it's not this big, mean machine that's trying to like oppress and destroy women, which is one of the stories. That's not helpful for women to see their maternity services as that. But it is helpful to look at where it emerged and, you know, how it came out of, it kind of came off the back of really, really early on the ancient philosophers like Aristotle, and then religion, that this idea that women's bodies were malfunctioning versions of men's bodies, you know, not quite as good as men's bodies. And then science came along, and medicine came out of science, and there was the whole idea that if men could just, you know, control women's bodies, then they'd do a better job. And the idea of the world as a machine, and, you know, and then the body became a machine, and medicine evolved looking at separate parts of the body. You know, we had heart specialists, and then we had, you know, uterus specialists. And the idea that, you know, if we do these interventions, we can make this, you know, not very effective machine function better. So that was how science evolved. And then we had, you know, the grafting women's cervixes onto like grafts, and then imposing those grafts onto women. This is all before evidence-based practice. This was just coming out of a cultural idea that women's bodies needed medical support in order to be safely birth their babies. So the intention was good. You know, we were just all crap at birthing and we could be improved. And then along came evidence and research, which was actually in the 70s, and it wasn't really implemented until the 90s. So this is real new stuff. And then the research started looking at what happens and going, oh, I think we might have been a bit wrong there. And that intervention actually causes problems. But it was already there and it was already a cultural norm. So then we're in this situation where we've got all these things happening that were implemented without any research evidence. And we're trying to get all the research evidence to argue that it shouldn't be happening. And that's where we're at with the maternity services. So it's this really weird, frustrating space. And it is changing very, very slowly. You know, each iteration of the guidelines are shifting into, I think, the right direction. You know, I've watched the normal birth guidelines in Queensland, which I've been on the working party for. So when I first came sort of a decade ago, they were pretty medicalized, and each iteration they're getting better. So it's now written in guidelines, you know, things like don't tell women to push, women should be spontaneously pushing, all these things that research is supporting. But practice is culturally based. So you've still got practitioners who have been trained particular ways. That's why there's a resistance to midwives getting degrees and doing degree level education, because we start critically thinking. I have actually been told that before. The problem with your students is they're critically, they are too critical in their thinking. It was years ago. So they don't want this, because what you used to have is practitioners that were trained in hospital by the hospital to follow the hospital policies. So you've got this whole set up, and the intention is good. They genuinely think that this is best for women. So it's not like they're trying to, you know, be mean. It's that they genuinely think that it's safest for the mother and the baby to offer an induction. So that's what they're doing, or safer for the mother and baby for this intervention to happen. So if a woman can understand that these care providers aren't trying to like do them over, they're actually trying to help them, but they're coming from a perspective that, you know, is really historical in its making, and that actually on the woman's side is the law, in terms of it doesn't matter what they offer, that she has absolute rights to decline anything that's offered, even if it means that her and her baby will die, she has the right to do that. And if women understand what their rights are, understand how the system's set up, it's much easier to navigate through it. And also the care providers are covering their back, like we all do. You know, we don't want to be held responsible for something that bad that happens. And from their perspective, they genuinely think that a woman having a big baby might be bad. So there's, you know, that you've got to look at the whole holistic setting and what's going on and what's happening for different people. And if you can understand that this particular obstetrician, for example, is worried about the outcome and the impact that might have on her or him, then by a woman saying, look, I understand that that's your concerns, I've heard them, this is what I want to do, and I'm going to take responsibility for that decision and the outcomes of that decision. What I have seen numerous times is obstetricians and midwives in the hospital sit back away and go, okay, great, let's support you then, because they're not now responsible for it, the woman owning that decision. And I've seen, you know, almost, I've seen obstetricians and midwives in the hospital support some outlandish things that women have decided that they're going to do. It's hilarious. And they go along with it because the woman has absolutely owned that decision.
And that's where education is key, isn't it?
Totally.
And I mean, I kind of say to my parents, I'm like, we are the change our maternity system needs to see. If we don't speak up for what we want, and if we go in having absolutely no idea of the options, absolutely no idea how our body works, then yes, then I advocate for caregivers as well, saying that's when they do kind of need to take that control, because they've got a woman who is just totally kind of out of it because of fear, of panic, and of course then her body maybe it goes into that tense fight or flight.
Yeah.
Compared to women or couples who do preparation, who educate themselves, who know their options, and who are confident in being able to talk with their caregivers and know what questions to ask, so they do feel like they are getting as much information as they can, so they feel like they're a part of the decision-making process to make an informed decision. That's something that I really... Do you know what though? I really think that there is a change happening. There are a lot more couples who are starting to realize this, that they need to take back that power and be the driver and not the passenger of their experience. Still got a long way to go, but like you said, it's like that ripple effect. And that's where, you know, interviews with people like you are helping, I guess, even for women to gain that confidence, because now, even just listening to you today, it's kind of like the way you explain things, it's like, yeah, actually that all makes sense. I want to learn more about this now.
Yeah, they should be feeling excited about their birth and feeling powerful when they go in to have their conversations than feel that there's a hierarchy and that they're just there to go along for the journey with the doctor. We have quite a lot of questions about IVF pregnancies. And I think a lot of women with IVF feel the pressure to be induced at 39 weeks. What is your thoughts on that?
I think I just got an unstable connection there and I missed the last bit.
That's okay. We're just seeing a lot of our parents that are coming through to work with us have IVF pregnancies, and they're feeling the pressure to be induced at 39 weeks. What are you feeling about that? Is that something you're seeing as quite a common thing, or
is there evidence to back it up?
Yeah, so it is pretty common. There's not any specific that I know of. They might haven't kind of really searched the literature. There isn't any evidence that I know that's looking specifically at women who have had IVF and their outcomes from induction or not induction. But we do know that if women have had IVF, then in general, their pregnancy has an increased chance of preeclampsia, of kind of pretty much all pregnancy complications. And there is an increased chance of congenital abnormality for the baby. So I think what's happened is that's being looked at as in this generalized risk for that population of women, and then that's why it's been offered. So I would suggest for women, they really need to be asking their care provider, could you, you know, what are the stats specific to my situation?
One of the other questions that I found that we had submitted on Instagram was, is one form of induction better than another? So is a stretch and sweep better than Syntocinin? Is artificial rupture of membranes better than a stretch and sweep? And we find that many caregivers are offering stretch and sweeps routine from like 38 weeks and telling women that it could help them avoid intervention and induction. What have you found in your studies? Is there one that's better than the other?
So it's all an intervention. And if you're trying to get the body to go into labor when it's not doing it itself, then that is induction. Okay. That's the kind of definition of induction. So membrane sweeping is step one in the induction process. So, you know, what you used to do is if a woman had agreed to have an induction, then your first thing you would do is a membrane sweep and see if that worked. And then you'd move on to, you know, getting a cervix ready with prostins or however you were going to do that. And then the next step would be the, you know, break of waters and put the drip up. So if you do membrane sweeps, you are more likely to go into spontaneous labor within the timeframes that have been prescribed. So what you now have is, again, well-meaning care providers who are then offering this intervention to save the women from other interventions. but it's an induction because you're still getting the body to do something that it wasn't going to do anyway. So it can work because it, you know, irritates the cervix and causes prostaglandin release, which can start to get the cervix ready. But remember, it's the baby that initiates labor, like in a physiological birth. So you've got membrane sweep, which is becoming increasingly common. And then you've got all the natural induction methods. You know, not many have, again, it hasn't been researched particularly strongly because, you know, research funding comes from big pharmaceutical companies. So there's not a lot of funding for finding out that something that hasn't got a profit can help. But women will try all kinds of things. And I guess the key thing is, it's still an induction and you need to question why you're having an induction. So if you're trying to get yourself in labor because of somebody else's prescribed time frame, then you might want to think you're feeling the need to do these things to yourself, meet somebody else's prescribed time frame, versus, for example, a woman who's booked in for an induction because of an actual pathology like preeclampsia, or there's something else going on for her, which means that she's chosen to have an induction because it's, you know, safer for her and the baby, then she might want to try some of these natural approaches beforehand. You know, I know a few women who have done that because she might just get herself into labor and avoid having syntocin on, you know. So it's really, you know, my perspective on it is, you know, do what you want your body. But just think about why you're doing it. Are you doing it for you, or are you doing it for somebody else? And it is induction. You know, whether you induce yourself with castor oil or, you know, with medication, it's still induction.
Yes, that's something I think we both definitely came away from after going to your talk, is that in the Hypnobirthing Australia classes that I teach, though, we do kind of give, you know, some ideas of ways that they could possibly try. But I definitely now approach it in a way of actually saying the way that you said it, that you can try these things, but if your body's not ready, it's not going to work. So if you are going to do anything, do it without expectation, and just kind of surrender. I think surrender is one of the biggest things
that women,
and that's the thing. I think not only are caregivers, I guess, trying to control, women are very much trying to control the outcomes as well. And that's not helping, at all.
But then it goes back to that. It goes back to history, doesn't it? You know, what we've been told is our bodies don't function appropriately, and that we have these external parameters put in place that we all then try and meet. And instead of actually deconstructing those parameters and going, well, why, and perhaps that doesn't work for me, we then try and get our bodies to fit the parameters instead of move the parameters to fit our bodies. And whether or not it's care providers or women, they're doing it, you know, they won't allow me to go longer than 42 weeks, so I'm gonna start trying to get myself into labor before then.
I know. And we just actually just helped a lady the other night, and I just had a phone call with her quite late in the night. She was really worrying about her induction the next day, to that, you know, she was getting herself in a terrible state. And I just said, oh, what do you do for work? And we just started talking about, you know, she ended up being like a corporate person who was very used to deadlines. And she said, well, I missed the deadline on this, you know, I've gone over my due date. And I was trying to just help her to understand that releasing of that is, you know, holding her back from actually letting her body do what it needed to do. So yeah, do you often feel that when you release the fear from the birth, that the woman naturally will then arrive into labor all by herself? Yeah. What do you do for women in that? What have you done in the previous time of being a midwife to help women with this?
Okay, so what I tend to do it before we get there, with when I was working in private practice, you know, you're seeing women all the way through, and we would discuss it right at the beginning, you know, particularly if they'd had previous babies, about what gestation that they birthed at, and really talk about what will happen at the end, you know, what time frames are going to be imposed externally, and then kind of what our thoughts are on that. And it's really about exploring. I think it's helpful for women to understand where the time frames come from, and how they got externally imposed and what they're there for, and to know that they're generalized, they're not applicable to an individual woman's body. and that they don't have to go along with them, and to really explore that. What does it say about you and your body if you're concerned about your body fitting into somebody else's parameters that are not necessarily evidence-based? So it's really coming back to that understanding where things that have, why are there time frames, and, you know, do you want to go along with that or not? Some women do. Some women go, I really actually do not want to be pregnant for longer than this amount of time, and I'm prepared to take the risks of induction in order to not be. And that's fine. And it's also, we need to acknowledge that, you know, pregnancy happens as part of a woman's life, and there's a lot of socialization going on before women come to pregnancy, and our belief systems are pretty much already set up, and it's all right to kind of make decisions based on other people's influence and on your belief system, because that's actually how we all make decisions. So a little bit of understanding around how decision making happens, and that it's actually all right to be biased in your decision making, and to acknowledge that other people are also biased in the information they're going to share. But ultimately, it's the woman's body. She has to be the person who makes the decision, and she's ultimately the person who manages any outcomes relating to that.
That's awesome. Thank you. That does help a lot.
So that really too, we're just looking at these questions as well that have been submitted. A lot of it is, you know, what about the 42-week rule? Are we allowed to say no to me going in labor? Then there was another one. What evidence is there, and what level of quality around the risks of post-dates over 42 weeks? Another one, what will the hospital midwives do if I want to go over 42 weeks? And that's, I guess, well, I find from the hospitals here are very much 41 plus three. That's kind of the magic date there. But then we're kind of saying, well, if you push up to 42 weeks, like what does the evidence say with if there are any, or what the risks are if women do choose and want to go over 42 weeks to allow their body to go into spontaneous labor?
Well, when we're talking about risks, which the, you know, whole maternity system set up on risks, it tends to be focused on very unlikely but catastrophic events. So, you know, you can look at lots of different research, and it's pretty much all saying the same thing, just slightly different percentages. So if you continue, in general, for a general population of women, so this is women who have got, you know, complications as well as not complications, then if once you start kind of getting into that 42nd week, you've got an increased chance of perinatal mortality. So that's stillbirth and early neonatal death. It doesn't get to 1%. We're talking about 0.0% and 0.0%. So that's the kind of area that we're having these arguments around. And it has to be looked at in terms of for the individual woman. So for a woman who normally gestates to 42 or 43 weeks, then those risk factors, that slight increase of risk of 0. whatever percent, depending on what research, is not applicable to her situation. She doesn't have any increased risk because that is genetically the normal gestation period for that woman. But because we don't know what the normal gestation rate is for individual women, then this fear around this really quite small risk, but pretty catastrophic, you know, it's the worst case scenario risk, that's applied to all women. So women need to make a decision as to whether they're going to buy into that, and that risk is really significant for them, or whether actually they're not, because the risks of induction of labor are more significant for them. So it's there is no risk-free, and I know the word risk is kind of a bit contentious, and you could use chance, but the reality is the word risk is used, and, you know, life is risky. I think we need to, instead of trying to get rid of the concept of risk, embrace it as part of our lives. You know, some of the best things in life are risky. So it's about how the woman perceives risk for her in her situation. And the reason for babies having an increased chance of perinatal mortality is still not known. What is known is, because as I've already explained, the baby starts labor, there might be something happening with that mechanism for babies who have congenital abnormalities. So babies who are already, you know, compromised in one way or another. So a baby who has congenital abnormality is more likely to be born early and more likely to be born late. So that might be one of the explainers. We don't really know. If a woman has had a baby, for example, at 39 weeks, another one at 39 weeks, and now she's pregnant, she's going into the kind of 40, 41 week, I would be questioning what is different here? What's going on for this woman and this baby? Because this is not her usual pattern. So it's about, you know, yes, looking at the general risks of a situation, but really looking at what's going on for this woman and her baby, because, you know, that's going to be more meaningful to the woman.
That's awesome. It's really good that people hear that. I think there's so much pressure, isn't there?
There is, definitely. Wow. Well, just to kind of, I guess, wrap up this interview with you, like, what would you like to say to women or the listeners? Like, what would be your recommendations for them if they are first pregnancy? What would be your top recommendations for them to prepare for, I guess, the most positive, hopefully natural physiological birth?
If that's what they want, know where you're birthing, understand the place in which you're going to birth, which is, you know, easy if you're having a home birth. You don't need to understand it because you already know it, but you need to know a little bit about where you're going. What are their stats? You know, what's women's experiences in that setting? And really, if you're birthing in a hospital setting, particularly without continuity of care, then it can be really helpful to have somebody along with you who is kind of on your side, knows you, understands what it is that you want. So, you know, that's where doulas are absolutely fantastic, you know, because they're not a family member, so they haven't got that big emotional context of connection with the baby, and they can kind of help to guide. And it's not about telling women things or educating women, or it's about kind of supporting their learning. And what do you need to know? Okay, how can we find that out? So I would say, if you're going to birth, you need to know about your birth setting. You need to know about the people who are going to be at your birth, what they're bringing, and, you know, question whether or not that's going to be helpful or not. And just, you know, really, pregnancy should be around building your trust in yourself. And that's not just in your body, but also in your capacity to make decisions, to own decisions, to take responsibility. So exploring, how do you make decisions? What are your beliefs around what? And that's okay. You know, it's all right to make a decision based on this is how we do it. You know, we kind of make the decision and then we find justification for it. And that's all right. But to really explore your own power in terms of, you know, not just your body, but also your rights in maternity care. If you're birthing, particularly in a setting, to know that you absolutely have the right to say yes or no to anything, and that overrides anything else. And that, you know, you, generally speaking, women's bodies have evolved to birth. And the main problem women have in a Western culture is the things we do to them get in the way of that. You know, it's different globally, where what women have the problem with is lack of intervention and access to intervention when they need it. But for most women, a physiological birth is the obvious outcome of a pregnancy, you know, if it's not intervened with.
That's brilliant. Mm-hmm. That's great advice for any woman coming into pregnancy or thinking about it. Oh, thank you, Rachel.
How could our listeners learn more from you? One, we highly recommend them buying the book, Why Induction Matters. But is there any other way that they can learn from you? I know you've got an amazing blog.
I've got a blog, but I tend to not use it as a blog, as in I don't just put lots of posts up there. I'll put a post up, for example, on gestational diabetes, and then I'll go back and update it with the latest research every now and then. So there's midwifethinking.com, which is the blog, which I kind of just keep updating all the, you know, key things like VBAC and prolonged pregnancy, etc. I do have a Facebook page, Midwife Thinking, and Instagram, Midwife Thinking. I'm actually not very good on social media, but I try. I go in and do a bit and then come back out and go, oh, that's too hard. But so really, Midwife Thinking in any of those platforms is probably the best way to keep up with me.
Amazing. And to any mums, if you are in Australia, please look out if Rachel does do any future talks, because honestly, we learned so much from attending your talk last year, and Thank you so much for the work that you do, from a mother as well, being a mum. There is just so much that, you know, women don't know. They don't know, you know, about their body, about the physiology of birth, about their rights, and how to stand up for themselves as well and advocate for themselves. So, yeah, thank you so much for the research that you do and the amazing book that you've put out. So, and we'll put all of the link in the show notes, but thank you so much for your time, Rachel. We really, really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
We hope this episode has helped you on your own journey. We would love it if you can subscribe and leave a review and help us to spread the word of positive pregnancy and birth.
We would like to personally invite you to join our Nurture Hub online community, where you can connect with other women and be mentored by us one-on-one in one of our future episodes. It's so important to feel connected and nurtured through this time, and we would love to support you.
Thanks for listening.